Listening to CPR, CFRC's prison radio show, which broadcasts every Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. right here on Queen's University Campus Radio and Community Radio in Kingston, CFRC 101.9 FM. You can stream us online at cfrc.ca. You can also visit our website, CFRC Prison Radio, at wordpress.com. Tonight's episode will be featuring content collected by one of our roving reporters, supporters, Facundo, who went out shortly before Prisoners' Justice Day to interview lawyers, law professors, and the general public about what they felt about incarceration. We didn't include it during our Prisoners' Justice Day broadcast because it doesn't actually talk to prisoners, but we did think that some of the opinions and information collected might be of value to the general public, especially those that are in the free world and would not know some of the detailed aspects of the criminal justice system, or quite frankly, are often badly and deliberately misinformed as part of agendas ranging from tough on crime to not so tough on crime. I'm not going to get into that, but let's just say it's some interesting interview that Facundo got, who's an exchange student from Buenos Aires and has a very different viewpoint on some of these matters too. Next week is Calls from Home here on CFRC. We'll be taking requests, messages, and letters of support. If you want to get a hold of us, the best way to get to us is to write us CPR or Calls from Home, care of CFRC, Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario, K7L3N6. That's Kingston, Ontario. K as in Kareem, 7, L as in Lenore, 3, N as in Nancy, 6. You can also email us CFRC Prison Radio at riseup.net. You can phone us 613-329-2693 to record a message. That's 613-329-2693. If you want to add that to your PID, you can ask for Alan Jackson, and his address is also Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario, K7L3N6. You can also phone us during the broadcast on our request line, 613-533-2372. Feel free to also join our Call from Home Facebook group if you happen to have access to the internet, and you can tweet us at twitter.com/CPRKingston. But let's get started right now on Facundo's interviews, which will take us through the entire hour here on CPR.
Anne, and I'm retired too.
Mm-hmm.
Len.
Okay, so the main question we're trying to tackle here is, do you think prisons should be first a place of correction or first a place of punishment, or in which degree each
well,
one of
I
them?
Well, I think in both.
Mm-hmm. But what do you think should be the main focus?
Well, it depends on the crime.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I think the main focus should be try to rehab, you know, so wherever would be the best place for whatever they've committed, you know.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about, here in Canada it was abolished, but it still persists in, for example, some states in the United States and in other countries around the world. What do you think about the death sentence?
About the what?
The death sentence.
Well,
that's a tough one. I wouldn't even want to
well,
judge that.
I say it's so unsure because there have been individuals that have been wrongly convicted.
Mm-hmm.
And like we have, I forget other incidences in the past, they were in prison for 15 years until the DNA cleared their name.
Yeah.
See, if they would have been executed, they would have executed as innocent people. So I think it's a thing that I really couldn't comment on. I wouldn't know. It's hard to say.
Another of the topics we're trying to tackle is there's many people who have been condemned to spend their whole lives in jail, but once they grow old, they require more extensive medical care, and that's sometimes very hard to provide inside the prisons. What do you think those people should be? How do you think that problem should be dealt with? Do you think the care should be provided inside the prisons as much as is possible? Do you think there should be special medical facilities? Some countries have tried with, for example, old people's homes who are secured just for inmates.
Well, I think the prisons don't have facilities for that.
Mm-hmm.
And so they should be transferred to some other facility where they could be taken care of, special facilities, you know. Mm-hmm.
They could still be incarcerated, but medically looked after as well.
Yeah.
Some people think it's better to just keep them at domiciliary prison, that is, just incarcerate them inside their own homes, not being able to go out, and then they can get whatever, service they need. Do you think that's an option?
Well, that would all depend upon the individual, what kind of an individual it is, and see if it's an individual that it would be not violent or hard to handle or so forth, I think, fine.
Mm-hmm.
But, it would depend on the individual.
How about privately owned prisons? Here in Canada, there's all prisons are owned by the state. There have been two situations where they tried to get privately owned prisons, but they were finally taken on by the state. But there's some countries, such as the U.S., where they have a lot of privately owned prisons. Do you think that's something that should be tried here in Canada?
I wouldn't know. I think the government's got to look after that.
Mm-hmm.
Solely.
I think that if they're privately owned prisons, then these individuals, I don't know what kind of it, they would have to be monitored very closely, because these individuals have the prisons to probably take advantage of the governmental system and would be just there to make money. They wouldn't be concerned about the individual in the prison.
It's Kathy.
Kathy, and you're here asking for help in the street, right? Did you have a job before or something?
I used to work in construction.
Ah, okay. So today is Prisoner's Justice Day, and the main issue we're trying to tackle here is, do you think prisons should be a place of reform and correction or a place of punishment?
I think it should be reform. People should be teaching them new skills and how to get out and deal with the public and not having to just resort to crime.
Mm-hmm. Many people I've talked to, and it's still legal in some states in the United States and across the countries of the world, think certain crimes should get a death sentence. What's your opinion on that?
I don't believe in the death sentence, no. When two wrongs don't make a right, you know what I mean? Like, just because one person died doesn't mean that the other person should die. And if you truly believe in the death sentence, the longer the suffering, the better the punishment, you know what I mean? Life.
Yeah.
Like, the longer the punishment, the longer, you know, the more they regret doing what they did, you know what I mean? If they're dead, then they can't regret what they did. It's just over for them, you know what I mean?
There were also some talking about people who were sentenced to spend their whole life in prison, who grow older and they become, you know, they need, yeah, exactly, and they need a lot of resources to be taken care of them. What do you think they should be done with those people? Do you think they should stay and receive the medical care inside the prison? Do you think they should be transferred to another facility?
They should be transferred to a different place, because if they're just like, it's the government that did it to them, that made them, well, not really the government, they did it to themselves by doing the repeat crimes. But I mean, after, it's just like people that are on pensions, that once they've been on a pension for so long and they don't know how to go out and find work and work and you know, and mingle with the society, and they give up. So they're just back in the prison again, taking up more taxpayer money, right?
Talking about taxpayer money, there's also been talk about private prisons. Here in Canada, there's no private prisons currently. There have been two intents of having them, and they were finally taken over by the states. But by the state, but for example, in the United States, it's a big controversy about it. Do you think there should be privately owned prisons?
I can't see why not. I mean, it would be a lot easier for people to, you know, deal with it. Then they wouldn't be complaining about how much taxpayer money that's going to feed the people. You know what I mean? They're just going to jail to get a place to stay in the wintertime. I know people joke around Kingston about that. You know what I mean? They just do crimes so they have a place to live and three meals a day. You know, that's bad.
Yeah.
This town has got too many prisons.
Yeah.
So, yeah, my name's Simon Boris. I'm a lawyer here in Kingston. I have my own firm. It's called Boris Law. Practice criminal law and correctional law.
Mm-hmm.
Criminal law is obviously the defense of people charged with crimes, outstanding matters in court. And correctional law, or sometimes called prison law, is the representation of people who are already incarcerated in prison, who are serving sentences. Typically, that is people who are serving what we call federal sentences.
Mm-hmm.
So they're serving sentences of longer than 2 years in a federal institution. And those are the institutions around here, like Collins Bay, Joyceville, Bath, Mill Haven, and then further out to Warkworth, in the town of Warkworth, Beaver Creek Institution in Gravenhurst, and then the Women's Institution in Grand Valley in Kitchener. So those are the federal institutions for people serving federal sentences of more than 2 years. And it also involves some representation of people serving sentences of less than 2 years, and those people are serving them in provincial jails. So like Quinney Detention Center in Napanee is one of those examples, or other ones around here would be Ottawa. Lindsay is the Central East Correctional Center in Lindsay, and Central North Correctional Center in Penetang. So that comes up as well sometimes with inmates serving shorter sentences, but less often, because they're often so short that they're in and out really before there's any issues to deal with. But inmates serving federal sentences certainly need representation on issues like parole and involuntary transfers or segregation placements and things like that. They have legal rights. They maintain certain legal rights, notwithstanding that they're deprived of their liberty. They maintain certain legal rights that they can exercise. They have legal rights to challenge a deprivation of their liberty, like a further deprivation of their liberty. So if they're transferred from minimum to medium, that's a deprivation of the liberty they had at minimum. If they're transferred from medium to maximum, same thing. If they're transferred from general population to segregation, they've lost something that they had. They've lost some liberty that they had, and they're entitled to have that reviewed by a court to determine whether it was reasonable and lawful. So that's an example of things I do for federal inmates, and also parole hearings and things like that. So I have a lot of experience dealing with inmates and correctional issues.
Yeah. Well, you know evidently a lot about the topic. Most people have a much more, you know, simple and direct opinion on whether correctionals and prisons in general should be. Some people think it should be more on the side of, you know, punishing the people in there, and some people think it should be more on the correctional side. How do you, as a lawyer, and, you know, how does the Canadian law deal with that encounter of opinion?
Well, I mean, I think that the law takes a balanced view of that. So I think that the law acknowledges that the principles of sentencing and the reasons why we incarcerate someone are multiple and varied, mm-hmm. and sometimes they're contradictory to each other. So, for example, we have principles of rehabilitation, and that might be one of the reasons why you sentence somebody, and it could even include the reason why they go to jail or prison for some element of rehabilitation, but typically rehabilitation would probably lean towards, you know, staying out of custody. You've got other principles at play, like denunciation and deterrence, right? The fact that we have to sanction the wrong conduct. There has to be a message sent to this offender, to the public at large, that this is not acceptable, and we have to denounce that in a way that sometimes causes that person to have to go to jail or prison. And so there's a tension between those. There's other principles at play as well, like the need to separate someone from society for the protection of society, which will, of course, almost always lead, you know, tilt the scales towards incarceration. But then we have other, even broader, overriding principles that are at play, including principles like totality, so that the overall sentence that someone receives if they are going to jail shouldn't be more severe than is warranted by the culpability of this offender in this circumstance. We have issues, other principles at play, like parity, which is that, you know, this offender should be sentenced as similarly as other offenders in similar circumstances, and things like that. So there's a lot of issues at play. There sometimes they come out of the statute, like the case law, or sorry, the criminal code, and sometimes they come out of the case law and from the Supreme Court and other courts that are binding on courts that end up sentencing people. Above all, though, I mean, sentencing is supposed to be, according to our Supreme Court, an individualized exercise. We're supposed to address this offender who committed this offense and do what's appropriate and just in all of the circumstances, taking into account all of these competing factors to determine what's appropriate. And that's an art form, really. It's not an exact science. You know, in the States, they use almost mathematical calculations for their sentencing guidelines, and there's not a whole lot of discretion. But here, it's about painting a picture for the judge to understand who your client is and make sure that they are treated justly and appropriately. You know, obviously, as a defense lawyer, I'm going to err on this side, not err, but I'm going to emphasize the principles that are favorable to my client, the principles of rehabilitation and things like that. That's my role. You know, the Crown Attorney's role is to put forward the principles in a fair way, because, I mean, the Crown doesn't just seek convictions or the highest amount of jail possible, but Their role is typically to emphasize the other side of the coin. Yeah. And then, of course, we leave it in the hands of the judge to make the just and appropriate sentence. But I think that, you know, as a defense lawyer, I will emphasize the elements and the factors that are in my client's best interest, but you can't, in doing so, lose sight of the broader principles that are at play. You're not, as a defense lawyer, a mercenary to just do whatever your client wants you to do or at all costs. And frankly, if you were to try to do that, you wouldn't be very successful, because you have to understand the judge is going to need to take into account all these other things. So you might as well weave them into your approach. That'll be more persuasive.
Yeah. It's very interesting that you brought, culpability and, you know, the amount of sentence. I was really surprised by the amount of people, of just, you know, general public people who don't know a lot about criminal justice, but many of them were in favor of the death penalty here in Canada, which has been removed from, you know, it's no longer a legal punishment, but it's still permanent in, for example, some states in the United States and across the world. What do you think about that? How do you see that there's so many people who actually think that it should be something for certain offenders, that was mostly what they brought forward, that it should be on a case-by-case basis? And on the other side of the coin, the people who said that it shouldn't be implemented, the main argument was, well, what if you sentence someone who's not guilty? How do you find the law deals with that kind of, you know, encountered opinion?
Well, I mean, obviously, the justice system is always concerned with wrongful convictions. Mm-hmm. We know they happen. They've happened historically. Those cases are famous, and they're confirmed cases of wrongful conviction. You know, not just a question of not being able to prove guilt, but, like, where it's been exonerated by DNA evidence or something like that. So we know wrongful convictions happen. We know that they're continuing to happen, and they'll happen in the future. The system is not perfect. It'll never be perfect, and I don't think there'll ever be a time where there's never a wrongful conviction again. So, of course, that raises the concern about having a penalty imposed that's permanent and irrevocable. If you kill someone or execute someone, you can't undo that if they have a successful appeal or a later exoneration. I assume, of course, you'd go through all the appeals process before you do the execution, but nonetheless, changes in scientific method and tools and technology can later exonerate someone, and that's exactly through DNA technology and advancements in that area that we exonerated people historically.
But do you think that the appeal for not going for a death sentence should be more on the side of, you know, the main purpose of, well, more on the side of we're trying to, you know, not kill people because of human rights and
I mean, I think that aside from what we just discussed, which is the obvious one of the obvious reasons why not to have that penalty, yeah, there are other reasons at play why you would not want that penalty. Like I said earlier, the law is concerned with balancing competing factors, right?
Yeah.
Including things like rehabilitation. And if you execute someone, you have chosen one factor to the extreme. You can't weave it together any other factors at play there, right? Executing someone is only satisfying the principles of, you know, punitive principles like denunciation and deterrence and permanent separation of someone from society. I mean, it's essentially an ultimate form of retribution for someone having violated the law. That's not a very balanced view, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And you know, it does require, sentencing does require balancing of those views, and I think just, you know, human decency requires a balancing of those views.
Yeah.
Such that we don't think that something so extreme that we should do to someone else what they did to someone else.
Yeah.
It just, in my opinion, seems a little bit illogical. Because typically you're talking about these cases for murders, or like serious crimes like that. To do to them what they did to others, there just seems something inherently flawed about that idea. And as I said, it is extreme, and it's not a balancing of all the competing interests in any kind of, I think what I would suggest, in any kind of reasonable way.
Another one of the topics that we're discussing is prisoners who have grown old, who have been sentenced to, you know, either life sentences or very long periods of time, and who have grown either institutionalized or who grow old and do not and you have to, you know, provide a wide amount of medical services to them. How do you find that the Canadian penitentiary systems deal with that? Do you think it deals with it correctly? Do you think there's other, like, for example, transferring inmates to private facilities or give them, you know, assistance on their own place, confined to a domiciliary prison?
So obviously, you know, prisons accommodate people of a wide range of ages. Some people grow old in the system. Some people don't enter the system until they're old. There are medical services provided. The Corrections and Conditional Release Act, which governs essentially the maintenance of correctional institutions and the administering of the law to prisoners, and its regulations, the Corrections and Conditional Release Regulations, talk about, you know, medical services being required to be provided, and certainly I think those, it's undisputed that those medical services should be of the same caliber and quality as for someone outside who's not an inmate. But the reality is that there are limitations on institutional resources. sometimes make that very difficult to do, especially for complicated cases or serious cases where people require extensive accommodation or extensive treatment. That is a difficult issue for the correctional service to deal with. I can appreciate that. Obviously, you know, I would certainly be advocating for my clients to receive everything they need, but I do understand that there has to be, as we discussed earlier, again, a balancing of competing interests. The correctional service does have limited resources and has to make do the best that they can with that. I think it would probably be unreasonable to expect everyone get everything they want, everyone get the perfect medical care. That might be the standard to strive for, but it may not be realistic in a real sense. Now, that doesn't prevent, you know, myself or others from advocating for people to get what they need in individual circumstances, but I think you just have to take a step back and have a bigger view of it. Now, there are other options available. There are opportunities to parole people for medical needs. It's called parole by exception, typically applied when people are terminally ill, and they can be paroled if their risk to the community is manageable to somewhere where that that will accommodate their medical needs. So there are things that can be done for those inmates, but certainly I think a lot of inmates struggle with getting the health care that they need. I would suggest that the healthcare system inside institutions could use a lot of improvement. Like I said, I appreciate that it has resource limitations, but I think that privately run prisons are a terrible idea. And the reason I feel so strongly about that is because the philosophy behind running a business is not the same as the philosophy behind running a prison. Or I shouldn't just say running a prison, but administering incarceration to people who've been sentenced to periods of incarceration. It's not the same thing at all. Running a business is about profits for your shareholders, profits for your owners, efficiency, and basic free market principles like that. Administering incarceration to people who've been sentenced to a period of incarceration is a responsibility of the government to its people who have all agreed to abide by, if you want to call it, the social contract that says you're going to be subject to the law. Whether you explicitly agree with that or not, you are going to be subject to the law by virtue of being in this country as a citizen or a non-citizen, and the government has a responsibility to administer those prison services, if you want to call it that, to people who've been sentenced. And as we discussed, that involves a balancing of a lot of competing interests, some of which are totally contradictory to making profit or to being as efficient as possible. And I think that it's a fundamentally flawed idea to turn those government responsibilities over to a private company, because they don't necessarily share. In fact, it's almost fundamentally impossible for them to share the same values and principles that the government should have when they're administering prison services.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you. If you have any follow-up questions or whatever, don't hesitate to contact me.
Yeah, actually, do you have 2 minutes?
I don't. I have to go up for 1:45 to speak in court.
Sure.
But if you want to stick around, I could speak with you further after that.
You can follow me.
You can follow up with me by phone or whatever.
Yeah, that would be great. Do you know, for those people with, because you mentioned the terminally ill, right? Is in Canada euthanization for people who are terminally ill an option, a legal option?
I'm not 100% sure about that. I know that there was. Sorry, I just got to get up from the third.
Sure.
I know that there's been some recent case law about that. The Supreme Court has decided some issues about that. Mm-hmm. I think Parliament is probably working on something about that.
Yeah.
I have not, to be honest, kept up to date on that to know what the parameters of it are, what the circumstances are in which it could be done or can't be done. So I don't know. But certainly, it's not something, I'm confident it's not something that can be forced on anyone.
Yeah, yeah.
But something that someone could choose in certain circumstances.
And do you think prisoners should be allowed to have that option if they were terminally ill?
I mean, but that's a bigger question. I think my answer would be I don't think anybody should, prisoner or not. But the reasons for that are
Good evening. You're listening to CPR, CFRC's prison radio show, which broadcasts every Wednesday from 7 to 8 p.m. Tonight's episode will be featuring content collected by one of our roving reporters, supporters, Facundo, who went out shortly before Prisoner's Justice Day to interview lawyers, law professors, and the general public about what they felt about incarceration. Next week is Calls from Home here on CFRC. We'll be taking requests, messages, and letters of support. If you want to get a hold of us, the best way to get to us is to write us, CPR, or Calls from Home, care of CFRC, Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario, K7L3N6. That's Kingston, Ontario. K as in Kareem, 7, L as in Lenore, 3, N as in Nancy, 6. You can also email us, CFRCprisonradio@riseup.net. You can phone us, 613-329-2693, to record a message. That's 613-329-2693. If you want to add that to your PID, you can ask for Alan Jackson, and his address is also Lower Carruthers Hall, Queen's University, Kingston, Ontario, K7L3N6. You can also phone us during the broadcast on our request line, 613-533-2372. Feel free to also join our Call from Home Facebook group if you happen to have access to the internet, and you can tweet us at twitter.com/CPRKingston.
So, yeah, my name's Simon Boris. I'm a lawyer here in Kingston. I have my own firm. It's called Boris Law. And I practice criminal law and correctional law. Mm-hmm. Criminal law is obviously the defense of people charged with crimes, outstanding matters in court. And correctional law, or sometimes called prison law, is the representation of people who are already incarcerated in prison, who are serving sentences. Typically, that is people who are serving what we call federal sentences. Mm-hmm. So they're serving sentences of longer than 2 years in a federal institution. And those are the institutions around here, like Collins Bay, Joyceville, Bath, Mill Haven, and then further out to Warkworth, in the town of Warkworth, Beaver Creek Institution in Gravenhurst, and then the Women's Institution in Grand Valley in Kitchener. So those are the federal institutions for people serving federal sentences of more than 2 years. And it also involves some representation of people serving sentences of less than 2 years, and those people are serving them in provincial jails. So like Quinney Detention Center in Napanee is one of those examples, or other ones around here would be Ottawa. Lindsay is the Central East Correctional Center in Lindsay, and Central North Correctional Center in Penetang. So that comes up as well sometimes with inmates serving shorter sentences, but less often because they're often so short that they're in and out really before there's any issues to deal with. But inmates serving federal sentences certainly need representation on issues like parole and involuntary transfers or segregation placements and things like that. They have legal rights. They maintain certain legal rights, notwithstanding that they're deprived of their liberty. They maintain certain legal rights that they can exercise. They have legal rights to challenge a deprivation of their liberty, like a further deprivation of their liberty. So if they're transferred from minimum to medium, that's a deprivation of the liberty they had at minimum. If they're transferred from medium to maximum, same thing. If they're transferred from general population to segregation, they've lost something that they had. They've lost some liberty that they had, and they're entitled to have that reviewed by a court to determine whether it was reasonable and lawful. So that's an example of things I do for federal inmates, and also parole hearings and things like that. So I have a lot of experience dealing with inmates and correctional issues.
Yeah. Well, you know evidently a lot about the topic. Most people have a much more, you know, simple direct opinion on whether correctionals and prisons in general should be. Some people think it should be more on the side of, you know, punishing the people in there, and some people think it should be more on the correctional side. How do you, as a lawyer, and, you know, how does the Canadian law deal with that encounter of opinion?
Well, I mean, I think that the law takes a balanced view of that. So I think that the law acknowledges that the principles of sentencing and the reasons why we incarcerate someone are multiple and varied, and sometimes they're contradictory to each other. So, for example, we have principles of rehabilitation, and that might be one of the reasons why you sentence somebody, and it could even include the reason why they go to jail or prison for some element of rehabilitation, but typically rehabilitation would probably lean towards, you know, staying out of custody. You've got other principles at play, like denunciation and deterrence, right? The fact that we have to sanction the wrong conduct. There has to be a message sent to this offender, to the public at large, that this is not acceptable, and we have to denounce that in a way that sometimes causes that person to have to go to jail or prison. And so there's a tension between those. There's other principles at play as well, like the need to separate someone from society for the protection of society, which will, of course, almost always lead, you know, tilt the scales towards incarceration. But then we have other even broader overriding principles that are at play, including principles like totality, so that the overall sentence that someone receives if they are going to jail shouldn't be more severe than is warranted by the culpability of this offender in this circumstance. We have issues, other principles at play, like parity, which is that, you know, this offender should be sentenced as similarly as other offenders in similar circumstances, and things like that. So there's a lot of issues at play. There sometimes they come out of the statute, like the case law, or sorry, the criminal code, and sometimes they come out of the case law and from the Supreme Court and other courts that are binding on courts that end up sentencing people. Above all, though, I mean, sentencing is supposed to be, according to our Supreme Court, an individualized exercise. We're supposed to address this offender who committed this offense and do what's appropriate and just in all of the circumstances, taking into account all of these competing factors to determine what's appropriate. And that's an art form, really. It's not an exact science. You know, in the States, they use it's almost mathematical calculations for their sentencing guidelines, and there's not a whole lot of discretion. But here, it's about painting a picture for the judge to understand who your client is and make sure that they are treated justly and appropriately. You know, obviously, as a defense lawyer, I'm going to err on this side, not err, but I'm going to emphasize the principles that are favorable to my client, the principles of rehabilitation and things like that. That's my role. You know, the Crown Attorney's role is to put forward the principles in a fair way, because, I mean, the Crown doesn't just seek convictions or the highest amount of jail possible, but they're their role is typically to emphasize the other side of the coin. Yeah. And then, of course, we leave it in the hands of the judge to make the just and appropriate sentence. But I think that, you know, as a defense lawyer, I will emphasize the elements and the factors that are in my client's best interest, but you can't, in doing so, lose sight of the broader principles that are at play. You're not, as a defense lawyer, a mercenary to just do whatever your client wants you to do or at all costs. And frankly, if you were to try to do that, you wouldn't be very successful, because you have to understand the judge is going to need to take into account all these other things. So you might as well weave them into your approach. That'll be more persuasive.
Yeah. It's very interesting that you brought, I mean,
Well, I mean, obviously, the justice system is always concerned with wrongful convictions. Mm-hmm. We know they happen. They've happened historically. Those cases are famous, and they're confirmed cases of wrongful conviction. You know, not just a question of not being able to prove guilt, but, like, where it's been exonerated by DNA evidence or something like that. So we know wrongful convictions happen. We know that they're continuing to happen, and they'll happen in the future. The system is not perfect. It'll never be perfect, and I don't think there'll ever be a time where there's never a wrongful conviction again. So, of course, that raises the concern about having a penalty imposed that's permanent and irrevocable. If you kill someone or execute someone, you can't undo that if they have a successful appeal or a later exoneration. I assume, of course, you'd go through all the appeals process before you do the execution, but nonetheless, changes in scientific method and tools and technology can later exonerate someone, and that's exactly through DNA technology and advancements in that area that we exonerated people historically.
But don't you think that the appeal for not going for a death sentence should be more on the side of...
I think that aside from what we just discussed, which is the obvious one of the obvious reasons why not to have that penalty, yeah, there are other reasons at play why you would not want that penalty. Like I said earlier, the law is concerned with balancing competing factors, right?
Yeah.
Including things like rehabilitation. And if you execute someone, you have chosen one factor to the extreme. You can't weave it together any other factors at play there, right? Executing someone is only satisfying the principles of, you know, punitive principles like denunciation and deterrence and permanent separation of someone from society. I mean, it's essentially an ultimate form of retribution for someone having violated the law. That's not a very balanced view, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And, you know, it does require, sentencing does require balancing of those views. And I think just human decency requires a balancing of those views, such that we don't think that something so extreme that we should do to someone else what they did to someone else.
Yeah.
It just, in my opinion, seems a little bit illogical. Because typically you're talking about these cases for murders or like serious crimes like that. To do to them what they did to others, there just seems something inherently flawed about that idea. And like I said, it is extreme, and it's not a balancing of all the competing interests in any kind of, I think, what I would suggest, in any kind of reasonable way.
Another one of the topics that we're discussing... is prisoners who have grown old, who have been sentenced to, you know, either life sentences or very long periods of time, and who have grown either institutionalized or who grow old and do not, and you have to, you know, provide a wide amount of medical services to them. How do you find that the Canadian penitentiary systems deal with that? Do you think it deals with it correctly? Do you think there's other, like, for example, transferring inmates to private facilities or give them, you know, assistance on their own place, confined to a domiciliary prison?
So obviously, you know, prisons accommodate people of a wide range of ages. Some people grow old in the system. Some people don't enter the system until they're old. There are medical services provided. The Corrections and Conditional Release Act, which governs essentially the maintenance of correctional institutions and the administering of the law to prisoners and its regulations, the Corrections and Conditional Release Regulations, talk about, you know, medical services being required to be provided. And certainly I think those... it's undisputed that those medical services should be of the same caliber and quality as for someone outside who's not an inmate. But the reality is that there are limitations on institutional resources that sometimes make that very difficult to do, especially for complicated cases or serious cases where people require extensive accommodation or extensive treatment. That is a difficult issue for the correctional service to deal with. I can appreciate that. Obviously, you know, I would certainly be advocating for my clients to receive everything they need, but I do understand that there has to be, as we discussed earlier, again, a balancing of competing interests. The correctional service does have limited resources and has to make do the best that they can with that. I think it would probably be unreasonable to expect everyone get everything they want, everyone get the perfect medical care. That might be the standard to strive for, but it may not be realistic in a real sense. Now, that doesn't prevent, you know, myself or others from advocating for people to get what they need in individual circumstances. But I think you just have to take a step back and have a bigger view of it. Now, there are other options available. There are opportunities to parole people for medical needs. It's called parole by exception, typically applied when people are terminally ill. And they can be paroled, if their risk to the community is manageable, to somewhere where that that will accommodate their medical needs. So there are things that can be done for those inmates, but certainly I think a lot of inmates struggle with getting the health care that they need. I would suggest that the health care system inside institutions could use a lot of improvement. Like I said, I appreciate that it has resource limitations, but that significantly affects inmates' lives.
One last question. Some people were talking about that given the limitation of resources, we're discussing the possibility of, you know, privately owned prisons. There were two instances here in Canada, but they were finally taken over by the state. And back in the United States, there's a lot of controversy about them. What do you think about that? How do you find the law deals with it here?
I think that privately run prisons are a terrible idea. And the reason I feel so strongly about that is because the philosophy behind running a business is not the same as the philosophy behind running a prison. Or I shouldn't just say running a prison, but administering incarceration to people who've been sentenced to periods of incarceration. It's not the same thing at all. Running a business is about profits for your shareholders, profits for your owners, efficiency, and basic free market principles like that. Administering incarceration to people who've been sentenced to a period of incarceration is a responsibility of the government to its people who have all agreed to abide by, if you want to call it, the social contract that says you're going to be subject to the law. Whether you explicitly agree with that or not, you are going to be subject to the law by virtue of being in this country as a citizen or a non-citizen, and the government has a responsibility to administer those prison services, if you want to call it that, to people who've been sentenced. And as we discussed, that involves a balancing of a lot of competing interests, some of which are totally contradictory to making profit or to being as efficient as possible. And I think that it's a fundamentally flawed idea to turn those government responsibilities over to a private company, because they don't necessarily share. In fact, it's almost fundamentally impossible for them to share the same values and principles that the government should have when they're administering prison services.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. If you have any follow-up questions or whatever, don't hesitate to contact me.
Yeah, actually, do you have 2 minutes?
I don't. I have to go up for 1:45 to speak in court.
Sure.
But if you want to stick around, I could speak with you further after that.
You can follow me.
You can follow up with me by phone or whatever.
Yeah,
or
that
email.
Would be great. Do you know, is for those people with, because you mentioned the terminally ill, right? Is in Canada euthanization for people who are terminally ill an option, a legal option?
I'm not 100% sure about that. I know that there was... Sorry, I just got to get up.
Sure.
I know that there's been some recent case law about that. The Supreme Court has decided some issues about that. Mm-hmm. I think Parliament is probably working on something about that.
Yeah.
I have not, to be honest, kept up to date on that to know what the parameters of it are, what the circumstances are in which it could be done or can't be done. I don't know. But certainly, it's not something, I'm confident it's not something that can be forced on anyone.
Yeah, yeah.
It's something that someone could choose in certain circumstances.
And do you think prisoners should be allowed to have that option if they were terminally ill?
I mean, that's a bigger question. I think my answer would be I don't think anybody should, prisoner or not. But the reasons for that are...
I'm a criminal law professor at Queen's. I've been teaching here since 1975. So that's 40 years, something like that.
A number, yeah. Lots of experience. The main question we're trying to tackle to get, you know, the people's idea is whether prisons should be a place of reform or a place of punishment.
Well, I think it's inevitable that they're going to do both. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of people in penitentiaries in Kingston are there for really violent behavior. Mm-hmm. And it's nice to think about the fact that we can have, you know, lives can be changed around, away from the path of violence. But in some cases, it's hard to imagine that isn't going to happen. I mean, there's some people in penitentiaries in Kingston will never get out for very good reason. They prove to be very dangerous. However, we over-criminalize a lot. I mean, and use prison far too much. I mean, like the Harper government, for example, produced this mandatory minimum options for all sorts of offences, so that there's no discretion not to send them to jail for certain times, certain offences. So, for example, if the cops come to your place and they find more than 6 marijuana plants, you're going to jail automatically for 6 months, which is very simplistic and stupid. So, so that in that sense, it's easy for politicians to say we're tough on crime, we're going to jack up the penalties.
Yeah.
Like the guy who was sentenced yesterday for 3 murders and given a sentence of no parole eligibility for 75 years by the time he turned 100.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in 20 years' time, it might make sense to release that guy, but he's never going to be released. So that's not sensible. Now, the Harper government also, in their policy of being tough on crime, just reduced, and just for strategic reasons, a whole lot of reformative measures. Like, for example, they just, not only did they cancel the prison farm program, they knocked down the buildings so that nobody could easily replace them, which is proving problem to the Liberal government.
Mm-hmm.
They've got to have a lot of infrastructure costs to bring it all back in. So I do think that reformation sometimes is, it's hard to sort of, with a broad sweep with a broad brush. I mean, for example, I'm thinking of a guy, Bill Marshall, who spent his life trying to reform sexual offenders. He claimed quite a lot of success because he really cared about it, but he would be the first to say that a lot of them could not be reformed. So the other thing that happens in prison is that sometimes old age, not old age, but young men who are often the people who are in prison get older. And so some chance events happen. Like, for example, one of the prison guards becomes a friend. Completely, it's not a formal thing, it's a happenstance. And that's good news.
Mm-hmm.
So when you ask me the question, are they there to reform or to punish, I think sometimes they have to be there to punish.
Mm-hmm.
And there certainly governments of the day, especially the Harper government, could have done a hell of a lot more to produce reform measures like get people off opiates, needle programs that are cancelled, drug programs, anger management programs, all this stuff just got cancelled. People were denied access to computers. And so when they get released, what's their chance of getting a job? They don't have computer skills. So it's a bit, one of the things about teaching criminal law is that we need to use the criminal law with the restraint, because when you get to the penitentiary scheme, it's not great. Also, the other thing is that there's very bad facilities at provincial jails, people being denied bail or for short sentences. Very little happens in the provincial jails. You get a 6-month sentence, you're going to be sitting in a cell for 6 months not doing anything, and that couldn't be seen as anything other than punishment and reformative measures at all.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned about prisoners who spend long times of period in prisons, because that's another one of the issues. There's been some talk about, well, especially prisoners who have been, you know, sentenced for life, and they start growing older, and they have, and they have greater medical needs. Do you think those prisoners should be? And, you know, inside the prisons, there's a limited amount of medical assistance that can be given to them.
Oh, absolutely, especially for mental health.
Yeah, exactly. Do you think they should be transferred to special facilities, that we should do whatever we can best to, you know,
well,
give it treatment?
That's a hard one, because the mental health facilities not coming from the criminal justice scheme have tried very hard to stop locking up people. And so there's still some locked facilities in provincial health systems, but they're very reluctant to suddenly have somebody who's committed a dangerous act into their midst. So personally, I think it would be more productive and more likely to produce change if they just produced a whole lot more resources for mental health facilities in the prisons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like some of those, as you probably know, you've got a prison with 300 or 400 people in it, and there's like one psychiatrist or something.
Well, some people have also been talking about the way of dealing with that, as for them not to be such a you know, to have to spend so many resources on them, the use of private facilities, privately owned prisons. What's your take on that?
Well, private prisons is awful. I mean, like we've had the experience in the United States, mm-hmm. where they privatize prisons and that just becomes a commercial operation. So first thing, the person who wants to make money out of prisons is to have mega prisons. So they just treble the size of prisons and cut out all the reformatory stuff, all the reformation schemes, because they're expensive. Cut down the number of treatises, just have guards, frog marching people around. So that's a very bad way to go. I mean, we under the Harper government, we sort of inherited a lot of what went wrong in the United States Supreme Court and state jurisdictions. They have three strikes and out and much more prisons. And that's what Harper got into. And so it's still not gone. The present Liberal government said it was going to get rid of most of those 100 mandatory minimums. It hasn't done it yet. Mm-hmm. It's been there for, what's it, 2 or 3 years, and they're still talking about it. Why? Because it's politically not a good thing to be seen to be soft on crime.
Yeah.
So it's a hard area to work in. What's your own interest?
Sorry?
Why are you interested in this?
Oh, well, right now, because I'm working for the radio,
yeah.
And we're doing the piece because today is Prison Justice Day, but I'm also a political studies. Maybe, hopefully, one day be a lawyer.
Right.
Who knows? If I'm lucky enough. You mentioned the U.S., and I was surprised, actually. I've been talking to, like, you know, some people, just regular people on the street who didn't know much about criminal justice, but a lot of them were in favor of the death penalty, even though here in Canada it's been abolished for a number of years, such as corporal punishments and such. But many people were in favor of death penalty on a case-to-case basis. What's your take on that?
Well, the death penalty was formally abolished in 1976. And at the time, the majority of Canadians were in favor of the death penalty. Mm-hmm. But so it's always been true. There's a Supreme Court decision called U.S. versus Burns, where the Supreme Court of Canada has made it pretty clear that they would say it's unconstitutional. And so now what's happened with a lot of people who could have faced the death penalty, including that guy who got 75 years yesterday, is it turns out that we make mistakes. And so not a lot, but enough to be worried. I would say there have been about 20 cases of wrongful convictions in the last 5 years in Canada, many of them involving these huge, big cases. Got the wrong guy, got the evidence was suppressed, something. And so we have to produce payouts for people that have been wrongfully arrested. So it's terrible to think that we could have executed them.
Mm-hmm.
So I think people, it's too glib. I mean, if you haven't been involved with the death penalty, I grew up in South Africa, and they used to, at that time under apartheid South Africa, there was the death penalty. There isn't now, because Mandela decided to take it off, thank goodness. But I used to attend courts and see judges actually impose the death penalty. It was terrifying. You'd sit there, there were 20 accused young guys who had been caught bringing some stuff across the border to free their black brothers in South Africa. Didn't know much. They were given money and guns. And so the judge would say, accused number one, I sentence you to 15 years. Accused number two, I sentence you to death. And, you know, can you imagine being in a courtroom when that's happening? Like, just picking and choosing. So that's it's one of the things that I think even the Harper government and most governments, federal governments, have not dared to say that they want the death mm-hmm. penalty back.
Yeah.
It's cheaper, it's more efficient, it's barbaric, and you're reducing yourself to the level of people who deliberately kill people.
Mm-hmm. There's also another side to it, because recently there's been discussion, you know, also in the federal court about euthanasia. So people who are terminally ill,
yes.
who right now, for example, are in prison and they're getting, you know, whatever treatment they can be provided inside the prisons. And this is again a very touchy, you know, it's a very fine line on what rights you
Canadians been divided for years about whether or not you can actually consent to to have your life taken away by a doctor. The medical profession, as you know, is very split on this, and they often see themselves as not being able to do them themselves. But it's the Supreme Court of Canada in Carter case that recently said we've got to have some euthanasia laws. Now, it's quite clear that that would apply equally to people in prison who are terminally ill. But Parliament's come back with a narrower form of it, which will again be subject to challenge in the courts. But it has to be a reasonable belief by doctors that you're going to die. So it's not like something like you're uncomfortable or in pain or something. So, but again, it's funny because some people, the same people, typically attitudes are really strange. Some people who would be quickly answering you and saying, I'm in favor of the death penalty, would also be against abortion, which is a fetus being killed. So that seems to be wrong, but you can kill a live human being. And euthanasia is often wrong for some people, even though they've never been in the situation and never been fully able to give consent that they would prefer that option.
Yeah, because...
See, when you talk about these big issues, though, like death, murder, death, manslaughter, all that's what everybody talks about when they talk about when you go around the street and say, what do you think, you're too soft or anything like that. You've got to realize that the vast percentage of criminal behavior is lesser than that. It's theft, it's minor fights, somebody throwing a punch, impaired driving, driving too fast, that sort of stuff. It's not deliberately killing people. So like we've got to be careful that when we generalize, when you ask me, do you believe in punishment or reformation? I would say for some of the deliberate killings when there was no real defense, like self-defense or anything like that, I think we have to believe in punishment. But for the vast percentage of offenses, we overuse the criminal law.
Would you... Do you have anything you'd like to... You brought this topic, and I completely agree. I think it's very hard, especially when just talking with people who don't know a lot about... criminal justice in general, to go into those, you know, more sensitive topics, because all they think about is, you know, criminals. And do you have anything you'd like to say about that, this today being Prisoner Justice Day?
Well, I would say that we know that there are some people that later on will discover they're being wrongfully convicted. A lot of prisoners in jail sit there and say, well, I've been wrongfully convicted. That turns out to be false. Most of them mean properly convicted. But the truth of the matter is that you don't have any empathy for criminals until one of your own family members does something stupid and is convicted of a crime. You know, politicians are interesting because when they say law and order and be tough on crime, suddenly when they're charged with an offense, they want all the protections that the law can give them, fraud, whether it's fraud, corruption, paired driving, anything. It's the very same people who would want to throw the book on, throw people in jail, want to say, oh, not me. So it's a hard area, and it's interesting. Fortunately, though, we have, notwithstanding all the politics,